Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Next week, one organization devoted to changing the paradigm of leadership will gather its followers from around the world for an annual meeting. And this year, for the first time, Authentic Leadership in Action, or ALLIA, devotees will gather in the United States, in Columbus, to be more precise. And that might be because some of our most recognized community leaders in Central Ohio are alumni of ALLIA. I don't know. I'm going to find out. Joining us today to talk about that is Upper Arlington City Manager Ginny Barney. Ginny also served as mayor and city council member at Upper Arlington. She was chairman for the Solid Waste Authority of Central Ohio, chairman for the Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission, and currently as chairman of Franklin County Emergency Management and Homeland Security. Certainly a leadership kind of person. Welcome to the show, Ginny.
Thank you, Ann.
And also with us is Phil Cass. He's CEO of the Columbus Medical Association and its three affiliate corporations, the Columbus Medical Association Foundation, the Physicians Free Clinic, and the Central Ohio Trauma System. Phil serves on the board of the ALLIA Institute, and we welcome you back to the show, Phil.
Thanks, Ann. Good to be here.
And by phone is Marty Janowitz. He's chair of the ALLIA Board of Directors. Welcome to the show, Marty.
Hi. Glad to be here.
You're going to be in town in just a few days.
I hop on a plane from Halifax, Nova Scotia, and a couple of planes later, I'll be in Ohio tomorrow.
So tell us about where ALLIA comes from, and it's a nonprofit organization, and how it ended up in Nova Scotia, too.
It's in Nova Scotia because about 11 years ago, a small group of people here who were interested in how both organizations, society, communities, businesses, and individuals change, got into conversation and reached out to other people we were aware of who were doing pioneering work around the world. And next thing you know, we hosted an event. It became so interesting to the people participating that we did it for 10 more years. And now this year, the process of being together and exploring these things for reasons I'm sure we'll discuss is now ready to come to Ohio.
And these annual meetings, they're not just for new people. People come back year after year after year. It's not like I've been to lots of leadership training things and seminars, and they've had consultants come into the companies I've worked for, and you never see them again. This is different.
Yes. When you described it in your intro, it may have sounded to listeners like it was a little bit of a cult, but it's
well,
not.
Well, you know what? Actually, I was going to use that word.
I think of it more as a clan of people who've discovered that they enjoy learning from each other, and we contribute, and we're trying to. It becomes a kind of a hearthstone for coming together and exploring things that matter to us.
Why is it important to come back to the people that you learn with to reconsider you know, the fundamentals of it?
I think that's a pretty straightforward end. We understood early on that learning is not an event, it's a journey. And so we spend time together. That brings up creative thinking, opportunities to experiment, new collaborations. And then folks go off to wherever they're working. Some of those collaborations have legs over the course of the year. But then we learn things, and we're ready to come back and say, okay, now what? And how can I take what I've now learned and mix it up again with people? So it is really like being more part of an evolving fellowship of people who are interested in personal and organizational and societal transformation.
My guest is Marty Janowitz. He's chair of the board of directors of ALLIA, Authentic Leadership in Action. Also with us today, Phil Cass, CEO of the Columbus Medical Association, and also Ginny Barney. She is city manager for Upper Arlington. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about leadership. We're talking specifically about a type of leadership that I don't know what the word is. You brought up the word cult, but
hardly. But,
exactly. Authentic Leadership in Action. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There is a quote on ALLIA's homepage, Marty. It's from one of ALLIA's founders, Margaret Wheatley. It says, "To navigate life today, we definitely need new maps. Our old ones confuse us unendingly. These new maps are waiting for us." What do you mean by a new map?
I think that, you know, the idea here, Anne, is that if you try to get new outcomes and you bring to the process the same way of thinking and the same patterns of how you do things, you're likely not to have anything change. And so our approach is that if we are interested in change, we have to include in our activity the reflective possibility, the contemplative possibility, the creative, even artistic possibility of looking at who we are and how we do things and seeing if we can evolve ourselves simultaneously with what we're trying to work on. And our experience is that that's the only way the outcomes start to change. And by the way, this is not meant to be airy-fairy. This is a volunteer role I'm at with Alia. In my work world, I work for a large publicly traded company. In fact, has a Columbus, Ohio branch called Stantec, and I'm involved in senior management work, and I find this activity helpful to me in doing the things I'm paid to do.
Courage is another word associated with Alia. Why is courage? What role does that play?
It's not easy to get into the personal space or the organizational space where we're not relying on the patterns that we're comfortable with, almost cocoonish with. In fact, I spent my morning today, I'm at Halifax City Hall, where I was with about 40 people representing business leaders, community leaders, very similar to what I know has been going on in Ohio. And we were in a process of looking at how we could work together in ways we've never worked. It takes some courage, because some people say, I got to go back to my board now and say, I'm doing what?
Ginny Barney, as the things you've learned at Alia play out in your role as city manager, mm-hmm. do people say that to you?
Absolutely. It's a lonely place when you're trying to go down a new path. It is a lonely place. And so I think the skills that I've learned at Alia and have really helped me, both within the organization but within the community. And just a couple years ago, we brought together volunteers from around the community to hold a conversation. What would it look like if you had a community conversation? Because in my world, you don't see citizens until they've already chosen sides on an issue. So if there's a new way to get beyond that and host a conversation about solutions, that's a terrific new path.
What brought you to Alia in the first place?
An invitation brought me, actually, from Phil, sitting right next to me, Phil Cass. And it posed that direct question, you know, can you have a different conversation, a meaningful conversation about important issues? Because I'm in a lot of meetings all the time, it seems like, and you do the same things, you follow the same agendas, and you get the same outcomes. And we need to look at the world differently, particularly with the resources being shrunk within government. When we talk about now, when I talk with other cities about sharing resources and sharing services, these sorts of activities and training I've had, I think, are going to lead the way.
So, Phil Cash, you're CEO of the Columbus Medical Association. Do you have people going, do you have the same sort of reaction sometimes, or do they not even know what you're doing?
Oh, no. And we've been, in our organizations, we've been working in this more collective intelligence kind of way for 8 or 9 years now. Part of what has happened is that many of us there have been 70 people from Columbus who've gone to Halifax for the Institute.
From all different organizations.
From all kinds of different organizations. And we've taken people from our own organization there as well. So we operate under an operating system, if you will, that was learned at the Institute that is much more about participatory leadership. To your point earlier about this issue of courage, you know, this country was founded on and still has a great belief in the rugged individual. I think all of us are maybe starting to understand that the world is so complex anymore that individuals really can't solve today's complex problems. And many of us who have been leaders who've grown up with that kind of mentality haven't had the benefit of learning the various kinds of skills needed to bring collectively people thinking together to solve problems. That's one of the things that has kept me going back to Alia all these years and why I've been committed to the board and why I was committed to bringing here. It's time that we all need to start to learn that to solve the kind of problems we've got today, it takes everybody's brain power, not just one or two people. And it takes courage to do that. It takes courage for a leader to say, I don't know. I cannot know all of what I need to know to lead this complex organization around these particular issues. That is very scary for people. And then to do so and not have the skills, know that you can't do it all, but not have the skills to be able to engage people is very, very frightening. What the ALLI Institute does is to say, that's true, and it takes courage to say it, and here's some skills for how we actually can work in a different way in our organizations, in our communities, in our own families.
Marty Janowitz, we talk about, Phil was just talking about skills. Can you give us an example of what sort of skill building you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a variety of skills that over the years have become pretty central to the work we do within ALLI. Some of it, comes from traditions as diverse as meditative traditions, contemplative traditions, but also it's not at all common to be in a leadership development situation where there's also an artistic component where people are given the opportunity to be creative with everything from movement or calligraphy or other types of disciplines such as that. But also there are theoretical pieces drawn from organizations and thinkers as diverse as IBM or MIT or some of the groups working with complexity theory or organizational change or strategic thinking and planning skills. So it's realizing that no one of these things alone can solve the problem, but by bringing them together in a pattern, what we call a container, with some form, some shape to the program. This is not like a typical conference where you're just going to breakout sessions. You work intensively with a group of people around a stream of collaboration or a stream of creativity, and you do that over the course of a few days together.
You can't read about the ALLI style of leadership without reading about cultivating, as it's already been mentioned, not only personal but also the collective awareness that's been mentioned. Is that the same thing as getting everyone on the same page? What do we mean by that?
Well, that's an important point. I was thinking about that when it came up. But by collective, we mean working together in a participatory, open, honest, direct way. It does not imply anything about doing away with a diversity of perspectives or a diversity of roles or a diversity of places we come from. Quite the opposite. Diversity is critical because we're not looking to meld things into one little simple thing as if everybody could agree on one point. We're more interested in how things work when diversity is allowed to come along, and you can still accomplish things by figuring out what is the common aspiration, how do we work together when we don't have to agree. Now, I'm a dual citizen, by the way, of the United States and Canada, so I live in both worlds. Forgive my occasional Canadian pronunciations. One of the things I see when I have my Canadian hat on, looking at what comes across the, and we do get American cable, thank you very much, so I get to experience some of that, is this kind of polarization towards very, very extreme views where it's all about being 100% right or wrong. Well, it's not likely that 100% right or wrong is going to lead to societal or organizational improvements. We're looking for a space where people can respect each other's experience when they're not in the same place.
We're talking about Authentic Leadership in Action. It is a nonprofit organization from Nova Scotia. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
We Weekday mornings, prepare for the day with NPR's Steve Inskeep and Renee Montaigne and hear local news updates from the award-winning WOSU News Team. Listen to Morning Edition weekdays from 5 until 9 a.m. on 89.7 NPR News.
And this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. 73 degrees in downtown Columbus. Clouds today, maybe a little sunshine and a high of 85. There's a chance of rain tonight, a low of 65 degrees. Cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms for Thursday and a high of 79. And still a chance of rain for Thursday night, a low of 62.
Support for 89.7 comes from Thurber House, presenting author and former Columbus Dispatch reporter Robin Yoakum as part of its literary picnic series, Wednesday evening, June 22nd. More information at thurberhouse.org.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back. We're talking about leadership. Coming up in a few days is going to be the first time Authentic Leadership in Action will gather in the United States, in Columbus to be more precise. And joining us is Marty Janowitz. He's a chair on the board of directors of ALEA, and also Ginny Barney. She's city manager for the city of Upper Arlington. And Phil Cass, he's CEO for the Columbus Medical Association. If you want to talk about leadership and want to talk about ALEA and specifically, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We had a caller who did not want to be on the air, Steve. He wants to know how a true leader brings out the best in the least of society. Who'd like to take a stab at that? Marty?
Sure. Well, you know, it's an interesting way of framing the question, because to say that someone is the least of society tends to imply that they have the least to contribute, and often along with that can come a feeling of powerlessness. If you feel that I'm not only more hard pressed to have my voice heard because I perhaps don't have power, but I'm perceived not to have power. What we are trying to do is figure out ways to bring all voices into the room. At the event I'm at, been at all morning long, it's very, very diverse, and there are some folks who, from a conventional perspective, would be considered at least somewhere in the realm of least of society. And what we start with is respecting experience. And so understanding that in any individual's experience is the heart of something that we often refer to as goodness, but really it's as much talking about the ability to bring genuine insight. Now, that needs an invitation. It needs to be supported, and sometimes those who have the better means to be involved in terms of capabilities, resources of all kinds, have to understand that the conditions need to be created for every element in society to be at the table, and that takes work, and it takes openness.
Ginny Barney, you were talking during the break about it, giving us an example of an everyday thing that you do to incorporate ALEA into your work.
Well, I think that the government or any organization is looked at as being the one that has all the answers. And when citizens come and they have complaints, they don't often bring solutions with them, and we don't ask for them to bring solutions with them. So we move from being the hero to the host of a conversation where they have a responsibility and an opportunity to contribute, where their voices are heard and they're part of the solution. And that's very different.
I imagine it rubs people the wrong way sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, you have people coming in
and
saying,
what
are you going to do for me?
Yeah.
And the reality is that governments and organizations can't solve all those problems. We're all having our resources cut short. That doesn't mean we can't find answers, but it means we need to be creative, and everyone has a responsibility to find those answers together.
And Phil, what about you? How does this come to play in your everyday work life? And you mentioned family as well.
I mean, it is absolutely part of every day in our work environment. The expectation is, if you come to work for the Columbus Medical Association, is that regardless of what may be defined as your ongoing work on a day-to-day basis, you have a responsibility around leadership. And we have found that some of the most elegant solutions to issues that we've faced have come from people who don't have titles that would suggest that's what their job is. But our expectation is that everyone has the capacity and actually wants to be able to contribute in that kind of way. And we constantly get solutions to issues that we're facing from across the organization. And that's really what this is all about.
Jerry in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ms. Fisher and all guests. Have any of you ever read the poem, The Calf Path, by Sam Walter? I'm trying to think of his last name. He lived from 1856 to 1912. I've got it up in my den. But anyway, he starts out with a calf, wandered and made a calf path. And then two centuries later, then we're still, the city grew by hundreds of thousands. And he says, now I infer that calf is two centuries dead. But men are prone to go it blind along the calf paths of the mind and work away from day to day at what others have done. In other words, what he's getting at is that we use the same style of leadership. And I would like to address the gentleman who's got dual citizenship. I worked for a man who later became president and CEO of our Canadian corporation, and I found he was retiring a few years older than me, and I've been retired over 20 years, so this is over 25 years ago. I got my house directory out, called the Toronto PBX operator, answered the phone. Remember them, PBX?
I do.
And I said, I'd like to speak to Mr. Taylor, please. And bang, his secretary's on the phone. I said, told him who was calling. He's on the phone. Hey, how you doing? I wanted to wish him well in his retirement. But anyway, he was a people person. Today, all we've got are bookkeepers and accountants in these companies. And we need more people persons, if you please. And I'll hang up and listen to your erudite young guest's comments. Have a great
Thanks,
day.
Thanks, Jerry. I guess one of the points I get out of Jerry's comment, Marty and Ginny and Phil, is that he took his call in
That's
the first
right.
place.
Well, he took his call, and from what I'm gathering, what is a people person? Well, we might think a people person is just someone who is accessible, and that's a nice thing. It's a wonderful thing. We're coming to the clear understanding that a transformational people person has to call and convene gatherings of people that are invited and hosted in order to come together in a way that can be constructive. In fact, we often use the term the art of hosting, because it's not simple, and it takes a real intention and willingness to say, okay, I'm just not going to bring people into the room, but what are the conditions that would allow people to engage towards a common purpose, understand a common need, apply the best skills? And that's kind of people personing, if you will, brought to the level of transformational challenge we're facing on so many levels today.
You really have to be a leader to do this, though. You have to be in a position of leadership, a position of power, because I think we've all been in those meetings where they say, come on, I want to hear everybody's idea. But you know, as soon as you stick your neck out, someone's going to chop your head off.
Mm-hmm. That's why this is a leadership practice for people who hold titles of leadership. But it really is a much broader cultural change in organizations that we will have there. I believe there's 14 people from our staff, and we're not a big staff, that will be coming to the Institute from assistants to people who have department leadership roles, because it's a cultural change that we've undergone. And yes, it had to start with someone to make that happen, but it's absolutely a cultural change.
Shambhala, is that how you pronounce it?
Shambhala.
Shambhala.
Mm-hmm.
It's from what I could learn about it, a network of meditation centers. It's a big influence on Aaliyah. What is it, and how does that fit into this way of looking at leadership?
Yeah, it's really been quite central to the emergence of Aaliyah's work. In that there were a group of Westerners, North Americans, who over the course of the last 25 or more years got involved in studying and learning about the wisdom traditions that come from other parts of the world, and particularly in that case, the Buddhist wisdom traditions that are built on the foundation of insightful meditation practice. Some of those people were simultaneously business people, educators, organizers of various types. And 11 or 12 years ago, from a group of folks that happened to be associated with that tradition, came the inspiration to see how some of that insight, particularly that reflective insight that they had experienced as being valuable, could interact with more conventional Western forms or emerging progressive Western forms of organizational change in leadership. And one of the first people the group reached out to was the well-known thinker and writer Peter Senge, who became one of the key people that formed the Institute. Meg Wheatley was mentioned. She's one of the world's leaders in complexity theory, among other things. She quickly came along. And the next thing you know, Art Kleiner, who came from Strategy and Business Magazine down in Boston, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, became a kind of a collective think tank and work tank around these things. But one of the things that became clear was that we couldn't go the same route. So this is probably the only leadership or business collective leadership, organizational leadership thing that still believes a contemplative practice is an important part of strategic activity. And that harkens back to this continuing insight from that Shambhala Buddhist tradition, which comes from a Tibetan background. But that Shambhala community has no proprietary or ownership or any kind of organizational formal relationship with Alia. It's kind of like a wisdom pool that we reach into.
Phil?
You know, Anne, Ginny and I are Midwesterners.
Yep.
We've grown up here. And I think with that, I consider myself to have that kind of Midwestern practicality. And over the years of being involved with this institute, what's become clearer to me is that this institute is a place that on the one end of the spectrum invites people, faculty, and others that are willing to push the edges around important ways to think about leadership in new ways, while at the same time exploring ancient understandings of what it means to lead. And when we really think about the leaders that we admire, and I make that distinction between there's lots of leaders out there who have done wonderful, good things, but when we think about the leaders that we admire, the people that we would follow, the people who we say, I trust them. When you scratch the surface at all, and I've read a lot about leadership, what you find is they have some kind of contemplative practice. They are, if you read about their lives, they're journaling, they are in prayer, they are people, whatever one thinks of Harry Truman, he had his daily meditation walk. He didn't call it a meditation walk, but it happened every day. Significant leaders who we admire, if you scratch the surface, they've been practicing some of these things that the Alia Institute has just simply called out. I think it's been one of the things that is important and courageous about the Institute is that it has started to say things like instincts, intuition, contemplative practice, the arts, all have to do with leadership. And we've all known that. But nobody until, in my estimation, the Alia Institute has kind of started to put that together and say, these are real. Let's learn about them. Let's not only learn them, but let's train in them. And we know authentic leaders. That's not new. What's new is starting to understand what went into making them the people that we admire. And what this institute is about is trying to create and espouse a whole world of leaders that we admire. And I think we probably need that pretty badly.
When I think of courage in this leadership and on Alia, I think of the courage to be vulnerable, because I think in the past, leaders are supposed to have all the answers. And the ability to be vulnerable and to say, I don't have the answers, but I know we can find the answers together. That's a real shift change and something that I think requires a whole different training and a meditation process to get comfortable with yourself to be able to say, I don't know. But we will figure it out.
If I post the website on our website at WOSU.org, will people be able to learn about the meeting in Columbus? Are people going to be able to – are there still openings? Can people still attend it?
Absolutely. There's openings for the whole week. And for people who can't, on this short notice, take a whole week to do this, we have an intensive opportunity on Friday. It starts at 8:30 in the morning. It'll go into the evening. People can sign up all the way. Those of us who've been pushing this here in Columbus have said we're going to work up until midnight on the 23rd because I think it is such a unique opportunity. We've got Congressman Tim Ryan is coming as a speaker on Monday evening, who is a contemplative practitioner. He's going to talk about his topic is Mindful Nation. He's a congressman talking about what does authentic leadership mean and its importance in this country. I'm so excited to hear what he's going to have to say. Very rich chance on Friday to have an experience with him. Peter Block is going to be here, who is a well-known person in the area of leadership. He's going to be doing work with us. So absolutely, come on.
Now, we hear a lot about sometimes they buy full-page ads in the newspapers and stuff about these big leadership days that they're bringing in all kinds of people like, you know, everyone from, famous people. You know, let's just leave it at that. I don't want to out anybody. But is this the kind of thing it is where it's just one famous person after another, or is this something different?
People who come to the Institute will work.
What's different about it?
It's different in that you're not just spoken to, but you're invited into the conversation. So all of these workshops and classes, you are an active participant and a fellow leader for that group. And one of the exciting things for me in this conference will be sitting at a lunch table with people from South Africa and Europe and South America and Japan, and recognizing that they're all seeking the same thing I am, which is how can we be better at what we do and what we care about.
We're talking about ALEA, Authentic Leadership in Action. It is having their annual meeting this week coming up in Columbus. We'll post the website on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to learn more about those opportunities to participate this coming week and learn more about ALEA. I want to say thanks to my guests right now, Marty Janowitz. He's going to be boarding a plane from Nova Scotia in just a little while. Thanks for joining us, Marty.
Oh, my pleasure. Looking forward to those 70s and 80 degrees I heard in your weather report.
That was at 6 o'clock this morning, but
I'll take it any time of the morning.
He's chair of the board of directors for ALEA, and also Ginny Barney. She's city manager for the city of Upper Arlington. Ginny, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Phil Cass, CEO of the Columbus Medical Association. Phil, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Ann, for having us.
Coming up, we're going to talk about some other kinds of change in the Short North Gallery District. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Chris Weitz. He directed the new film, A Better Life, about a father who is an illegal Mexican immigrant trying to give his son a better life in the U.S. Weitz also directed New Moon, the second film in the Twilight series, and co-directed American Pie and About a Boy. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes starting at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News. And as an 89.7 NPR News listener, nobody knows more about our programs and core values than you. We'd love to hear how we are doing. This is your chance to give us direct feedback. Visit WOSU.org and take our brief survey. Thanks in advance for your time and your support of 89.7 NPR News. And President Obama will address the nation from the White House tonight at 8 p.m. Listen to 89.7 NPR News for live coverage and analysis as the president lays out his plan for troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. Tune in for special coverage from NPR News. That's tonight beginning at 8.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Ohio Craft Museum and Gift Shop, presenting glass, ceramics, jewelry, and more made in American studios. Located at 1665 West 5th Avenue. Information at ohiocraft.org.
Partly sunny skies today, a high of 85, a chance of rain tonight, a low of 65. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. A few years ago, a Short North Gallery Guide listed 16 galleries, including the Ohio Art League. Since then, five of those galleries have closed. Most recently, the Rebecca Ebel Gallery on High Street and the Ohio Art League has left the Short North, too. Some joke that the monthly Short North Gallery Hop should change its name to the Short North Bar and Restaurant Hop. My guests today say they get the joke, but they're here to argue that the Short North Arts District is alive and well. Duff Lindsay is owner of the Lindsay Gallery on North High Street. Welcome to the show, Duff.
Thank you.
Also, Sherry Hawk, she's owner of the Sherry Gallery, also on North High Street. Welcome to the show, Sherry.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming all the way from North Carolina for the show.
Thanks.
Duff, you say the Short North Arts District isn't dying, merely evolving. So evolving from what to what?
Well, I think it's been a process all along. And yes, a lot of galleries have closed in the last 2 years. But when you think back many years ago in the Short North and how galleries come and galleries go, the Elizabeth Fergus Jean Gallery, Spangler Cummings Gallery, Acme Art Company, galleries like that were very alive and vibrant galleries. They're gone, and other people came along to take their place. And I think we've seen some of that same evolution happening in the past couple of years. There just seemed to be a flurry of them. But when you think individually about who those galleries were and why they closed, it's not really a failure of the Short North. Rebecca Ebel got her dream job and closed her gallery to take her dream job. Jackie Mahan, the Mahan Gallery, mm-hmm. she had two small children, suddenly realized maybe she didn't want to be, spending so many hours at her gallery and really wanted to take her life a different direction.
I met Jackie when we had a program revolving somewhat around WOSU's neighborhood series, Columbus neighborhood series. We did they did a documentary on the Short North, and it was wonderful. By the way, if you ever want to learn more about that, you can go to WOSU.org and find our link for that. But the issue came up several times that this is it. You can call it evolution, call it what you want, but it's inevitable as you develop a district like the Short North. There was the day when it was the cheap place to go. Maria Galloway would say, hey, that was where they could afford to open up their shop. They happen to still be there, but that you can't afford to open up. The Acmes of the world can't afford to open up in a place like Short North anymore. Sherry?
Well, I have my lease with Sandy Wood, and he is – and really appreciates the fact that galleries need to be in the Short North to maintain as an art district and really make the Short North special. So he gives accommodation to galleries in the rent, and there is talk of forming a fund, if you will, to any landlord that, rents to a gallery to have a lower rent, and then they could be subsidized, and that's going to be part of the SID and the new SID that starts in January. So there, and even still, I can't imagine a lower rent area for the traffic and what comes with that. Yes, the rents have gone up a little bit, but you get a better traffic and attention, and the area is better, so there's more business.
The other thing is the gallery district now really spreads all the way up to Fifth Avenue, whereas in the beginning it really all was kind of around the area of Rigsby's and where Sherry Hawk Gallery is right now. So as you get farther north, the rent tends to be a lot more affordable. So I think in an evolution of the neighborhood, it's growing, it's spreading, and as we see the new fringes, if you were, that's where the galleries are going to be able to afford to open a new gallery.
We're talking about the Short North, and that's an evolution. If you have a question or comment for our guests, Duff Lindsay, owner of the Lindsay Gallery, or Sherry Riley Hawk, owner of the Sherry Gallery, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Are you a fan of the gallery hop? Were you a fan and you've kind of changed because the Short North has changed? Give us a call and tell us why. 614-292-8513. What about young artists? Are you afraid, Sherry, when you talk about the opportunities that are there and people like Sandy Wood and what they're trying to do for them, do you think that they just look at it and they're afraid to even ask?
For new galleries coming in?
Yeah.
I think Duff is exactly right. The north part of the Short North.
That's where they're going.
Yep. And it has that excitement and energy like I remember the beginning of the original Short North. It was very exciting down there, like galleries like Rivet, young owners doing young work.
Yeah.
They draw a great audience.
What about the gallery hop itself? Mm-hmm. I remember it back 20 years ago, and it was a lot of fun, and I enjoyed it. But, you know, for some people now, it's just they can't find a place to park. It's so crowded, particularly if it's not raining outside, which, you know, it's kind of a crapshoot these days, but...
Well, the thing that we find frustrating is we constantly hear that we don't come to the gallery hop because we can't park. But gallery hop really starts somewhere around noon and goes to perhaps 9 or 10 o'clock. And in the middle of the afternoon or even early evening, sometimes there's nobody there. And then it gets incredibly crowded around 8 o'clock. So if people really want to come and see the art, if they come in the middle of the afternoon on Saturday – they can find a place to park. I think people have gotten a little wound up about the parking because they've gone down and to dinner in the evening or whatever and had trouble finding a place to park. And the other thing to never forget is there are valet parking stands all up and down High Street, and they will take your car even if you're not going to their restaurant. So you can always valet park.
614-292-8513 till the end of the hour if you want to talk about the Short North. Kent Rigsby kind of went against trend. Instead of opening up another successful restaurant, he opened a gallery, Ray's Living Room. And, you know, that was different that he did that. Tell us what you know about that and why he did it. I tried calling him. I couldn't get a hold of him, but I thought that was interesting. Sherry?
Well, my gallery is right next to Rigsby's, and they traditionally, even the gallery before my gallery there, they use the space for private dinner parties, and people really love that, to be in the ambiance of the art. And as that kept growing and they needed more and more space, it became really hard to use my space for that. So they had the opportunity with the space. It was just a couple doors down, and it's just a private, beautiful dining space. They can create any event. So that's why they did that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it shows that the gallery scene in the Short North is not dead, because if someone with the business savvy of a Kent Rigsby is opening an event / gallery space, he knows that it's happening down there, and he's not going to do that unless he believes that it's still a vibrant and ongoing scene. And look at a gallery that recently opened in the Short North, the Brant Roberts Gallery. Brian Roberts has a gallery in Bexley, and apparently he had originally intended to keep his gallery in Bexley and then have a gallery in partnership with Michelle Brant in the Short North. But they've done so well in the Short North that he's now closing his gallery in Bexley. So that says to me that the gallery scene, the arts district, as it were, is hardly dead. That this is we're seeing the next wave now.
A lot of people, the gallery hop will be the first or the only time they ever really get into a gallery and enjoy themselves in it. A lot of people can't afford to buy. Do you have any suggestions or advice for people who just want to gallery hop on their own time and see things without feeling, you know, for some people, intimidated?
Well, that's why I love the gallery hop. I mean, that opportunity, and frankly, like when everyone that comes into the gallery on the gallery hop, they follow a procedure. They come in one side, go out the other, and I see everyone looking, enjoying, discussing the art. But that's true any time, any day of the week. We are there to greet people, educate them. I don't expect someone to walk in off the street and buy work. I want to tell them about it. I mean, that's awesome.
Well, that reminds me of a time I walked into a fabulous gallery in New Orleans, and they had, you know, masters. I mean, it was so way, you know, and I walked around. He goes, can I answer any questions? I said, really? I'm not buying. And he said, No one ever does off the street, darling.
That's great. Oh, okay.
And that's so true. You know, when we greet people when they come in the door, obviously we say, feel free if you have any questions. And so often people will, they'll kind of, you know, recoil and say, well, I'm not going to buy anything. And I just laugh and say, well, it doesn't cost anything to ask questions. Because people like Sherry and myself, we love this stuff. Obviously, who would work this hard if you didn't really love it? And we love to talk about it. And it's an education process. And, you know, that 25-year-old who's just gotten their first job, who can't really afford a piece of art, who comes in, that's our customer of the future. That's 5 years from now when they start to get into their acquisitional years. Hopefully they're going to remember that they had that good experience at Gallery Hop and someone was friendly to them and answered their questions. And that's the wonderful thing about Gallery Hop.
Get those calls in, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, there's just the simple survival, and I'm interested. You two have teamed up rather than compete in a way on Gallery Hop Night. Tell us what you're doing together now.
We, Duff and I, have been collaborating probably 6 years now.
Yeah.
And doing dual openings. And for me, the relationship with Duff has been so helpful because it goes beyond just that we collaborate on our openings, which customers love because they can see two great shows together. But I respect Duff and his field, and to have someone that is like myself in that regard makes it easy for me to refer people to him. And we both are educating and really trying to help people collect great work and build great collections. So doing that together.
So how does it work?
Well, basically, we'll several times a year, we'll have our openings at the same time, usually on a Friday night before Gallery Hop. So the show is already in place for Gallery Hop. And by the way, several other galleries in the Short North now also have openings on Friday night before the Gallery Hop. Mm-hmm. And so we cooperate on our mailings. You know, a gallery lives and dies by its mailing list, so the gallery owners tend to jealously protect their mailing list. But Sherry and I have really opened it up to each other because we feel that the more people we expose, the more people we educate, it really benefits each other and really all the galleries, because the getting into art collecting really is an education process. So if I can educate some of her customers about the kind of art I carry and she does the same thing, it ultimately is good for everybody.
The economic downturn, for lack of a better, mm-hmm. Love a one-syllable word someday, but a lot of these galleries have closed down over the last couple years. They're not getting replaced immediately. Is that because of the economy, and do you see that changing? What are your expectations?
Well, I think that is why Duff and I are working together to help build an audience for art. And it is going to take a little bit of time, and the economic downturn has had an effect, but it's made us dig down deeper to do a better job at everything that we do.
I'm curious because it seems like your market, the people who buy art and can afford to buy art, that market hasn't changed that much during this, or is it just a psychological thing?
Well, it's changed. It is different in my experience. And one of the things I've noticed is the for lack of a better way to put it, a lot of the middle class collectors are holding back a little bit. You know, if you go into Short North galleries, you'll find art anywhere from $200 to $50,000, and people will still buy art that's $200, $300, $400, $500, $600, and the people that collect art that's $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, they're still buying art. It's the collector that would buy things that were $2,000 or $3,000. Perhaps they're holding back a little bit. So perhaps we've had to rethink some of what we do in those price ranges, and to work harder toward finding museum quality pieces that are in the high end, because the collectors and the museums that buy in that price range, frankly, they're still buying.
We had a caller. They said that it's Charlotte, and she said it's cheap to take the bus. The number 2 runs the length of High Street, and the number 7 goes to the Short North too. Do you find a lot more people doing that on Gallery Hop Night?
Oh, I think so. And bicycles, too.
Yeah.
We see a lot more bicycles in the Short North and on Gallery Hop. And we love that because that's every bicycle I see, I think that's one more empty parking space.
Yeah. They actually just put in a bunch of bollards up and down High Street for bikes. Pretty new just in the last couple of weeks.
Sherry, you've been in the district for a long time, as long as I've been shopping there. What has changed the most from where you sit?
The growth. I mean, the fact that now the Short North is a connector between Ohio State and downtown is so exciting. And I look at when I opened the gallery 25 years ago, we looked at Cleveland and Cincinnati, and those cities have not been able to maintain art districts. And the fact that Columbus is growing is very, very exciting. I'm so proud of Columbus and the support of the Short North.
And when I have customers who come in from out of town, whether they happen into my gallery because they're here for a convention or whatever, or they're clients of mine from New York or Chicago who are in Columbus for some reason and come to see me, they are blown away by the Short North. They say they've never seen anything like it. They're shocked to see something like that in a city, a flyover city like Columbus. And so it's a real jewel that I think that we take for granted.
When people, you know, in those profiles of people in magazines in the area, when they ask them, where do you take friends from out of town? It's often is the Short North. Mm-hmm. That or, you know, Easton. But it's usually somewhere to shop, that's for sure. Coming up, 614-292-8513. We just have a minute left if you have a question or comment for our guests. Sherry Riley Hawk, owner of Sherry's Gallery, and also Duff Lindsay, owner of the Lindsay Gallery. What's coming up the next gallery hop?
Right. Well, July 1st, Sherry and I have another one of our cooperative openings. It'll be 6 to 9 p.m. on Friday night before the gallery hop. Everyone's invited. You don't need an invitation to come to these. They're both local artists and people we're very excited about, and everyone's certainly welcome to come and
well,
get your taste
of it. Tell us who you have coming.
I have Mark Thomas. He's a self-taught artist from Columbus.
And you specialize in self-taught?
I do, and this will be his second show. We gave him his first show 2 years ago, which virtually sold out, by the way, and so I'm really excited. Excited for how his work is developed.
And Sherry?
I have Hiroshi, who is an artist from CCAD, the College of Art and Design, and he is known for his photography, but in this case, he's actually creating like the old box that you would look into, and you turn a crank, and it's kinetic, and you look through a peephole and see a little scene that moves. So this is brand new work,
kind of like dioramas, but that moves.
Yep.
Okay, well, I want to thank my guest, Duff Lindsay, owner of the Lindsay Gallery. Duff, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And also Sherry Riley Hawk, owner of Sherry Gallery. Sherry, thanks for making it all the way here from North Carolina.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus. And streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.